AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hello and welcome to the WTF1 podcast. I'm your host, James Coker, along with Luke Francis. Hi, Luke.
Hello, James. How is everyone?
Doing great. Today we are going to be previewing the Formula One Heineken Las Vegas Grand Prix 2025, another night race on the Formula One calendar. This is now, I believe, the third year that F1 has raced in Las Vegas. And I got to tell you, I am so excited.
Yeah, it's the new, I guess, well, it's the biggest kind of showbiz race of the year now, right? It's on the Las Vegas Strip, right? It has to be the biggest glitz and glam. Obviously, there's Monaco, which always has that crown jewel, that heritage. But Vegas is only 3 years in, and it has instilled itself as a instant classic. And yeah, based on last year, you were there last year, but I heard very, very good things from all people around. Not just the experience, but I think the brand presence, activations, it's clearly the most commercially attractive race for a lot of brands around the world. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that it has going against it is the fact that it's towards the end of the calendar, towards the end of the year. And I think by this time, a lot of brands and sponsors have used up their year's budget for like activations. So you might see more at a place like Miami and COTA than you do in Vegas, but it's still a race that everybody wants to be at. I feel like it's stolen a lot of Miami's thunder in that way. And it's just getting to see it under the lights, getting to see the cars going down the strip. I'm sure if you live there, it's a pain in the butt. But getting to go to Vegas and stay on the strip and walk 15 to 20 minutes to get to the entrance of the track, it's just a really cool race experience and very, very exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I think, from a spectator point of view, it's definitely up there in terms of Formula One in cool places, more than I'd say anywhere else on the calendar. I think that's pretty fair to say. I think as well, what's interesting, and I don't know if this is intentional. Of course, as you say, you sort of reach the end of the season, possibly championships are decided. I think in 23, when Max won, it was decided before Vegas. So you get less interest, I guess. But I think where Vegas positioned itself well in the calendar is for those kind of commercial discussions and getting brands to the track. And it's that period before the end of the season where they're trying to get deals finished for new sponsorships, you know, get more money into the teams or the sport itself. And so it's starting to be used as like basically a big networking event for Formula
100%.
One.
And there was like a business summit in Vegas, earlier in the week, correct?
Yeah, there's a F1 business summit, essentially. Yeah, as you just mentioned. So, it's becoming the hottest new networking event in motorsport, essentially, as well as the cars, of course.
And I know often this late in the calendar, it could be a dead rubber race. And while it is a dead rubber race for the constructors, we still have a hot battle for the Drivers' Championship. But before we get into that, let's talk some Formula One headlines, shall we?
Yes, there's been a few bits of news. Nothing sort of massive, no kind of massive breaking headlines, but a few bits I think would be worth touching on, whether that's feel-good moments, slightly less feel-good moments, and some informative pieces. So a few days ago, The race put out an article essentially outlining the new livery rules for 2026. One thing that's annoyed me over the past few years is we wait months and months for these new liveries each year, and they come out and they are basically just carbon. We've had it for the past two seasons, roughly, where teams are essentially just trying to save weight wherever they can, and there's no rules in place to stop them from essentially painting or not painting the whole car at all and keeping it all carbon and every car looks the same. Whereas now they've actually implemented rules for next year, meaning all teams have to cover at least 55% of the surface area when you view it from the front and from the side. And that 55% has to be covered in paint or a stickered livery of some kind. So essentially, it just means we'll be getting some cooler liveries next year and not a load of carbon.
I am so happy about this because I remember at the beginning of last season, this was a big thing where there's so many cars doing livery reveals and it was just like carbon fiber, carbon fiber, carbon fiber. And I'm so glad they're finally implementing paint minimums because listen, yes, we love to watch sport to see how humans can push the limits of what we are physically capable of doing. But we also watch sports for the pretty colors.
For sure. And you look back in the days of, you know, the 90s, the 2000s, and it looked like a rainbow when you looked at the grid. You know, yeah. You had bright yellows, bright pinks, bright reds, bright greens. You do have a lot of color now, don't get me wrong. But I think it was a good example, I think, is when you look at the, what would it be, the McLaren from maybe 2018, when it was basically fully painted orange.
Yeah.
To the past few years of McLaren, and it's sort of they've made it an orange and black livery purely to allow that carbon to be shown. So it just means we'll see branding and character come back to the cars, which is
I want a full yellow car again. What was it? Was it that Jordan Camel? Was that?
Oh yeah.
Is that what I'm thinking of?
Benson and Hedges Jordan from the sort of early 2000s, late 90s, kind of.
Yeah.
Frentzen drove it. It was an eye catcher. I think Renault almost got there with the Renault in the sort of 2017, 2018, 2019 years.
The one I'm thinking of is the Lotus. It's the 1988 Honda that was fully yellow with that was fully sponsored by Camel and blue text, and that is a gorgeous car.
Oh yeah, and there's a picture actually. So Senna drove for them in 87, I want to say, when Lotus turned into that yellow. And there's a very cool picture of Senna in full yellow overalls next to a full yellow car with Camel plastered all over it. So that's a legendary shot, and he's got some very cool sunglasses on too. So
yeah.
Those are the days that are gone, but hopefully we'll bring them back. Where's Camel?
Some team needs to bite the bullet and give us a yellow car. We need it. We need a rainbow on the grid, people.
Agreed. I think I remember the last year must have been 2019 maybe, or 2020, where we had orange, I guess it would have been 2020, orange McLaren, yellow Renault, pink
Luke,
Racing Point.
Not orange.
Sorry, McLaren fans, please.
Okay, Papaya McLaren, then what?
So we had Papaya McLaren, yellow Renault, pink Racing Point.
Yep.
I guess we would have had, obviously Ferrari red.
Sure.
From that point on, it maybe got a bit more boring. But we had these big colors. You know, the pink Racing Point, I think, was the last fully painted, bright colored car that we had on the grid. So it won't
like
quite
snack
be that
at a patisserie. I loved it.
It looked like it was covered in icing. It was delicious. Anyway, moving on.
Speaking of liveries, Audi F1 revealed their concept livery in a teaser to hype fans up for Audi's entrance to Formula One in 2026. What are your initial reactions to this livery tease?
So I think it's a bit of a weird one. I think everyone in the space has sort of looked at it and gone, is that the livery? Is it going to look a lot like that, a little bit like that? I know they've said it's a concept, but I think it looks a bit flat. It doesn't give me speed. There's that massive sort of divide in paint between the silver and the Audi kind of hot red or whatever you want to call it. And yeah. It's just, there's no flow to it. So I hope that's not the livery we see.
Also with the silver and the red, it kind of reminds me of the McLaren chrome and red of like, what is it? Was it the early 90s? The Sinan Prost drove?
The Marlboro.
Or am I thinking later on, was that Raikkonen and Hakkinen who drove?
That'd be the Vodafone McLaren.
Yeah, the Vodafone
McLaren. Yeah.
That's what I think of when I see that color scheme. And I know Audi probably has brand guidelines and like they're a sleek, you know, luxury brand in the automotive space. So like they probably only have a few different colors that they can sort of experiment with and use. But I just like, I don't know. It just didn't feel cool and interesting.
No, it didn't. It seemed a bit flat, I think. Yeah. I actually saw quite a few things saying, someone was like, we want an Audi livery. You know, we have an Audi livery at home. And then the one at home was that livery, the one we just saw. And then there was the one that Audi released when they first announced that they were getting into Formula One. Do you know the one I mean? That was very graphic. It wasn't very symmetrical, but it was very cool. There was lots of colors and shapes going on the livery. It would have been basically when they announced that they were joining the sport.
Okay.
It was in a sort of 2022 concept, I guess, chassis. That looked a lot cooler, I gotta say. But we'll see what they come up with at the start of 26. I'm sure once you get some brands on, once you get, the livery tweaked a little bit, because it's, I think the bare bones are there. It just needs a bit of spice to give it something else. That's what I see.
A little bit of spice. Word. Next up.
So speaking of, well, McLaren, kind of Hakkinen, or sort of. Hakkinen's nice daughter. That was very smooth. Hakkinen's daughter has joined the McLaren female driver program.
That is daughter of two-time Formula One drivers champion Mika Hakkinen from 1998 and 1999.
Correct. Absolute legend of Formula One. One of the best characters in the paddock these days. His daughter, joining one of three Ellas. Joining the female driver program for McLaren,
Ella.
Clearly, Zach Brown loves Rihanna, but I'll let him answer that. That's not the reason they were chosen. They are very, very high performing female drivers. But Mika Hakkinen, of course, is very, very happy about this.
Sure.
He showed, I guess, the most emotion we've seen from a Finn in Formula One for quite a while, I'd say. Yeah. Touting his daughter as a leading force for female drivers, looking into the future and basically saying, you know, in a certain amount of years, women will be pushing for those seats. And he feels very strongly that his daughter Ella will be leading that charge. So I'm very excited to see how she develops and if she is even an ounce of what Mika was, she's going to do amazing things.
Yeah, excited to see what she does on the track.
And speaking of women in the motorsport space. Yeah. These have segued quite well, haven't they?
Yeah.
So this one isn't such a happy story. I think quite a contentious one we've seen over the past few days. But Sky Sports launched a few days ago, about a week ago now, maybe just less, Sky Sports Halo, which essentially was a platform across social media pages, TikTok, Instagram, intended to be a female-focused platform for women to, I guess, enjoy the sport in what they saw was how women enjoy sport, which I think essentially got a lot of backlash. It was framed as Sky Sports. This is labeled on their profiles. It was labeled Sky Sports' Lil Sis, which I don't know how that came close to getting approved.
I can tell you, none of them asked a woman whether it was a good idea or not.
Correct. Yeah. They saw one TikTok and thought, oh, that probably makes sense.
It was made but by a bunch of like white men in their 40s and 50s, like, you know, who are my age and older, who like are completely out of touch. They did not consult one woman this entire process. Like, there was a guy who's like the director for Sky Sports who like made a response on LinkedIn being like, this was 100% a female led project. And I was like, are you throwing women under the bus now? Yeah,
that's, it
was
not 100, a good look.
It was 100% female led project. You told a bunch of women what to do and didn't ask for their input, or you didn't listen to them when they gave their opinion.
Yes, pretty much. And I think, yeah, the content, a lot of people just thought it was a joke. It was that sort of insane. It was just generally very demeaning and insulting to women, essentially portraying them in a way that meant Sky Sports felt they had to dumb down various sports, yes, just for women to understand it, essentially, or bringing in different topics to what they thought would relate women to that content. Things like matcha being used in various bits of content, essentially in their brains, to bring in female viewers. So it was terribly thought out. And I think it showed, given it closed after just 4 days. So I want to say yesterday, 2 days ago, they closed it completely and closed a door on it and released a apology from Sky Sports directly to, well, the sports community.
They were like, we're just going to make a sports channel for the girlies, the twirlies, and the hurlies. Honestly, y'all, is Helmut Marko brat?
Are you sure you weren't behind this, James?
Or they're going to show some Premier League highlights, and they're going to show Jared Bowen of West Ham scoring a goal. And they write, that feeling when that matcha Dubai chocolate BBL hit after that hot girl walk.
Thing is, you joke, but that probably was not, well, it wasn't far off. I mean, there was that one video of Erling Haaland from yes, the Prem.
Yes.
And he kind of broke through some tackles, and it was like when the matcha hits or something like that. You know, it's, yeah, yeah.
And then when someone like criticized them on TikTok, their response in the comments was, we don't like this energy.
See, surely a 40-year-old man can't be saying that.
I don't know.
No, it's crazy.
We'll be like, anyway, we don't like this energy, girl. We're going to go get some Botox-flavored skinny girl margs. Oh, sorry.
Shall we talk Las Vegas?
Yeah, let's talk Las Vegas.
So, some race facts.
To be clear, I had nothing to do with Halo.
Thank you for the clarification.
All right, let's preview the Formula One Heineken Las Vegas Grand Prix 2025, its full birth name. Let's do some quick race facts, shall we, Luke?
Yeah, quick race facts. Let's blast through them. So, Las Vegas returned to the Formula One calendar in 2023. As we said, it's the third year since the race came back to Sin City. Am I right in saying it's Sin City?
Yeah, Sin City.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's my British coming through. It was the first time they had hosted the Las Vegas Grand Prix since the mid-80s, and it has changed
dramatically. Early 80s. It was like an absolute shit show. It was like the Caesars Palace Grand Prix, and it happened in the parking lot of Caesars Palace. And it happened during the day. It was really hot. A lot of the cars overheated. I believe the cars went in a different direction. Like most Formula One races, correct me if I'm wrong, happen counterclockwise or clockwise?
Counter.
They happen counterclockwise. This one happened clockwise. So it was messing with the driver's necks because their muscles are used to feeling force in the other direction. Turnout was not good. Like in the 80s, the Vegas Grand Prix was just an S show, as they would say.
It was. If you look at the sort of track layout, it looked like the kind of thing you'd set up for a kind of Christmas go-kart in your local Sainsbury's car park or Costco car park for US viewers. So yeah, it just shows how far I think F1 have come. They went from a car park to the strip itself, which is pretty cool. So if you ever get a time, look back at those old videos from the 80s, because it is quite something to behold. Anyway, so last year we had Max Verstappen.
In 2024, Max Verstappen, I believe, secured the Drivers' Championship in 2024, but George Russell actually won the 2024 Las Vegas Grand Prix. And Lewis Hamilton finished second, and Carlos Sainz finished third.
Correct. Yes. Verstappen clinched his fourth with a fifth place finish, just getting enough points to see it over. That one wasn't such a memorable race, apart from Verstappen clinching the title, but I think the first year was probably the most memorable.
2023 was an incredible race, and it was so interesting because there was so much build up and so much hype going into the race. A lot of people were like, oh, it's going to be a shit show, like they're not going to be ready. And then of course we remember in FP1 Carlos Sainz ripping off a manhole cover, causing millions of dollars of damage to the floor of his Ferrari. He then got a grid penalty for it, which was insane. And they had to pay to, I believe, like totally redo the car and maybe even replace the power unit. I forget the specifics on it. And everyone was like, this is poorly run. F1 like gave people like a gift card for like the F1 merch shop instead of giving them a refund for the session for FP1 and FP2. Because they ended up not letting fans watch FP2. And so everybody going into the race on Saturday night was hating on the Vegas Grand Prix. But let me tell you, it silenced all of the haters, myself included, because the 2023 Las Vegas Grand Prix was a banger.
For sure. I think the fact it was so good, yeah, it sort of makes us forget all of those crazy moments in the first few days of the event. I think every race for the first time is tricky. I remember the Miami race for the first time was, yeah, complicated, whether that be across the fan experience, hospitality. I know from various people that worked that race, it was, yeah, an S show, as you said. So it's always going to be tricky. But I think, in this case, the fact the race delivered so much just let people forget about those moments. And I was watching from afar, genuinely worried that this was going to not do a maybe kind of 2005 when the tires exploded at Indianapolis, causing the US fans to fall out of love with Formula One. I didn't think it would be that bad, but it was definitely a moment where everyone sort of held breath going, yes, are they going to figure this out? What's going on here? This is not good at all. I know there were lots of things coming out of news as to why and solutions, and it was one of those moments in F1 where everything is figured out in hours, and there's lots of speculation, social media is going crazy, but yeah, it was a showdown on the Saturday, of course, for Vegas it's a Saturday race, which was so memorable.
And it was a late night race. It was like 10 p.m. Vegas time, which made it 1 a.m. for the East Coast of the United States, which is super late. So, you know, I think it really varied on the ratings. Like, I don't know what time it was in the UK. I want to say it was like 6 or 7 a.m. if I'm the math is mathing. But
4 a.m.
4 a.m.? Well, damn. But they're actually – it's a earlier race time this year. It's 8 p.m. as opposed to 10 p.m. So that's great for the American audience. I also like want to mention that there are some very weird features of the Las Vegas Grand Prix that we don't see in other races. Instead of a cool down room, they have a cool down car where they like get into the back of like a Rolls Royce. So I said instead of a cool down room, it's a cool down vroom. And it feels – thank you. Thank you very much. But it feels very weird. They're all like sort of bunched into the back seat of like this Rolls Royce or something like that. And they're all kind of quiet and they don't really know how to like conduct themselves as they're taken to the post-race interview spot, which is in front of the Bellagio fountain. And then they get back in, and then they go back to the race to go to the podium. It's just like a really weird vibe. It kind of reminds me, if you've ever seen the movie The Graduate. Have you ever seen The Graduate?
I've not actually, no.
Oh my God. Unbelievable film. Young Dustin Hoffman. I'm going to spoil it for you. At the end of the movie, he crashes a wedding of the girl he has a crush on and says, like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't marry him. And she agrees to, like, leave the altar with him. And she doesn't get married to this other guy. And she runs off with him. And everybody at the wedding is trying to, like, grab him and keep him from ruining this wedding. And they jump onto a bus and they get in the back of the bus and they're all happy and excited. And then after like 10 seconds, they sit there in silence and they're like, okay, what now?
I've seen that scene.
Okay.
See, I'm a consumer through 60 second clips on TikTok.
So that's what I think of when I think of the Las Vegas Grand Prix. They've just driven for like an hour and a half to 2 hours, driving upwards of 200 miles per hour, adrenaline pumping. They just won the race or they're on this podium, and then they have to sit in the back of this car and it's just kind of like quiet and awkward. And they're like, okay, what now?
I can see this being a continuation of Verstappen's and Kimi's bromance.
Yeah.
Just both of them sat at the back, kind of going, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those races where they do too much, I think. My favorite moment of Vegas trying too much was the announcements. And I think was probably the first year, but possibly last year, when they got, was it Bruce Buffer? I think.
Bruce Buffer, Michael Buffer's brother, when he got into Checo Perez's face.
Yes, and did his full Checo intro, and Checo thought he was getting an interview. So he walked over to Bruce as if to sort of answer some questions, and Bruce just kind of screams in his face, looks at him, and just kind of nods going, yeah, and then looks down at his notes, and Checo, oh, you can hear him going, where do I go? What do I do? And he's just so unbothered by all the, like, glitz. He's just like, can I just get in my car, please?
That clip was so awkward.
It was legendary.
So they did driver intros similar to that last year. Bruce Buffer was there with Michael Buffer, but I think maybe Bruce Buffer just took it down a notch and wasn't as extra. I don't remember because I didn't watch that part on TV because I actually was down there in pit lane. And F1, Emily Prazer, Chief Commercial Officer of Formula One, was like awesome in hooking me up with Paddock Club tickets last year as part of a partnership with the Vegas Grand Prix. And as you know, if you have Paddock Club tickets, you're able to go down to pit lane before driver introductions. So I was down in pit lane looking at all of them, get all the cars ready. Teams were getting ready. And as I was trying to go back up to the top floor of the paddock building, which is where my assigned area was, they roped off the area and I couldn't leave. And I happened to be right at the rope where the drivers were walking from the garage to the track for driver introductions.
Oh, brilliant.
So I got video of all the drivers walking right by me. As they were doing the driver introductions, and I got video of Bruce and Michael Buffer there as well. But I never watched the actual intros on TV.
Did you see Checo in that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was he sweating and looking nervous and worried about that happening again? Or was he just like, I'm not going to get involved?
I don't think so, because like they had, you know, it's roped off. There's fans watching on both sides. They kind of like have tunnel vision, and they occasionally like look over and wave to the fans who are like cheering for them, but they're just sort of making their way to the track.
Locked in.
George Russell was wearing sunglasses at night. He had like a giant Mercedes. He had a giant Mercedes puffer on, like white puffer jacket on, and was wearing sunglasses at night. And instead of turning to the crowd who was cheering for him, he just like put up a peace sign and kept walking forward.
Yeah, we love Russell. He's, yeah, that's such a Russell thing to do.
Such a goober.
He loves it. He loves it. One thing that impressed me a lot, actually, about, and this is maybe a bit of a segue, but when I was in Austin, I went to the amphitheater to watch the sort of driver interviews on the stage in front of all the fans. And Russell was so impressive. I feel if there's any driver on the grid, in my eyes, that would be a brilliant pundit, it would be George Russell. His ability to command a crowd, like they had a presenter with them asking the questions to Russell and Kimi, and he was basically leading it himself. You know, he was asking questions directly to the crowd, and the interviewer wasn't really doing anything. So he's an interesting character, but a very impressive, I guess, public speaker, you'd say.
Right.
I'd say more than most drivers.
Yeah, he'd be good. And you're going to have to forgive me for saying this, but I feel like Nico Rosberg, he probably has the agency to be a little cunty.
I think he, yeah, I agree. I think we've seen him with the issues he had with Verstappen.
Sure.
Where was it last year where he was so like used to giving in to Max? And there was a interview in the media pen where he specifically asked for the interview so that he could basically push back against Max and essentially chat shit back
right
to his face. So no, definitely. I don't think he'd be quite the like Jacques Villeneuve, Ralph Schumacher tinfoil hat kind of presenting, but he'd definitely show his opinions.
I think Ralph Schumacher and Jacques Villeneuve give like those tinfoil hat clickbaity quotes to stay relevant in the media. But I actually think Jacques Villeneuve is a good like race analyst. Like listening to his commentary when he's like on with Crofty, like he's so knowledgeable and gives really, really good insight. I can't speak to Ralph Schumacher because I don't think I've ever watched a race that he's called, but Jacques Villeneuve is very good at what he does.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it must have been the Canadian race he would have done, I'd have thought. But yeah, I remember, similar to how Brundle can essentially, with such detail, describe a lap from start to finish, how the drivers are going about each corner, how much they're doing throttle, all of that. Very similar with Villeneuve, I thought. So,
yeah,
I think he should maybe stick more to, that more informative-based presenting, because, no, I think sometimes his opinions are a bit unfair on some drivers. But, yeah, he's a brilliant, brilliant commentator.
Let's talk some track facts, shall we? Well, as we know, most driver wins, it's only happened twice. Max Verstappen won in 2023. George Russell won in 2024. Most team wins, Red Bull in 2023. Mercedes in 2024. We had a double Red Bull podium in 2023. It was Max P1, Charles Leclerc P2, Checo Perez P3. And then last year, if I'm remembering correctly, it was George Russell P1, Lewis Hamilton P2 for Mercedes, and Carlos Sainz Jr. P3 for Ferrari.
Yes. In terms of the track itself, it's one of the longest we've got on the calendar. Obviously, Spa is up there. Baku is pretty long. But this one stands at 6.2 kilometers. So it's one of the longest. 50 laps, hence the length of the track. 17 turns, two DRS zones, one between turn 4 and turn 5, and then one along the strip itself between turn 12 and turn 13. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure there was one between what would have been, I guess, turn 16 and the first corner, where the sort of straight turned into a bit of a dogleg. And they allowed DRS, I want to say the first year, but then it was deemed a bit too much because there was quite a harsh left turn.
I would have to go back and look, but I do remember one of those DRS zones being sponsored by Duracell.
Interesting. Do you remember which one?
No.
Interesting. That's a good bit of brand placement. Yeah. Race lap record, Lando Norris last year with a 134.876 all-time lap record. George Russell in qualifying last year of a 132 3-12. Interesting to see if they get quicker this year. Too sure. I mean, we've seen a few laps getting beaten this year with these new cars, but not all of them. So we'll see what happens.
Here's a question. But before they have, now that they're not going to have DRS anymore, we only have three races left with DRS. RIP, pour one out, send one up. Next year, we're going to have MOM, which is like manual override mode or whatever it is. Or MOM. Are we going to have, instead of DRS zones, are we going to have MOM zones?
I think we will.
If so, are those MOM zones going to be sponsored by Frida Baby and Similac soy-based formula? Like, what kind of brand synergy can we find for the MOM zones?
I think we're going to see Aston Martin and their baby strollers all over it.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a new demographic of viewers they're aiming for here with Formula One. The sort of 0 to 5 is quite a niche. niche audience to go for, but maybe it's worth it.
Maybe. I have a friend who has a Ferrari baby seat in their car.
Genius.
It's pretty nice.
I can see it working.
And they're not necessarily like motorsport or car people. They were just like, it was the best seat we could find for the money. So it happened to have Ferrari branding on it, so we bought it. I was like, great, love that for you.
Nice casual fans.
Let's talk championship, shall we?
Yes, we have a championship on our hands, and it's one that's hanging in the balance, I'd say. We've been in a state where each weekend has the ability to shift the championship in a new direction. Last weekend, it completely shifted it towards Lando Norris.
Oh, yeah.
He dominated Brazil, essentially, basically taking full points from that weekend. Piastri, on the other hand, struggled a little bit. That form that we've seen continued of being just off the pace generally and lacking. Obviously, he crashed out in the sprint race due to a bit of water on the curb, which he ran over. So, bit of misfortune, lack of pace. But essentially, this is what it looks like. We've got Lando Norris on 390 points, leading the championship. We've got Oscar Piastri second on 366 points, 24 behind Lando Norris. So that's 1 point less than a race win worth of points. And then we have Max Verstappen in third, 49 points behind Lando. I don't know about you, James. I feel Max is out of it now. 49 points is a lot.
The only way Max is back into this is if we, in Vegas, we get a double DNF from McLaren and Max gets P1. Otherwise, I don't see a realistic situation where Verstappen is able to really make a push for the championship.
Yeah, I think a couple races ago, we were in a point where Max, if he essentially just kept winning and McLaren finished second, he was in a point where the maths worked and it was in his favor, where if he just put in good performances each race, he would be back in the fight. But now with only three races left, one sprint race, there's just not enough points for him, even if he was to win all of them. So yeah, a bit of misfortune for McLaren is needed for him. I would also argue a bit of misfortune is needed for Oscar Piastri to close that gap. I think this weekend, it just feels like a make or break weekend for Oscar. Essentially, if he doesn't outscore Lando this race, there needs to be some sort of bad fortune for Lando. The points gap is 24, three races left. If that grows any bigger, I think he's in a really, really difficult spot.
Remind me, is there a sprint in any of the three remaining weekends?
The Qatar will have a sprint race. So there are more points to gain. I think in total there would be 83 points available in terms of winning each race and each sprint race remaining.
Just trying to do some quick math here. Let's say in a world where Oscar finished P1 in all three Grand Prix and the remaining sprint, and Lando finished P2 in all those races, that still would not be enough points to overtake Lando for the championship, because that's 7 point swing per race plus a 1 point swing for the sprint. So that's 22 points with a deficit of 24. You're absolutely right. Not only is Oscar going to have to win outright, but he's going to have to count on Lando either having some misfortune or just really sliding in performance these remaining three races in one sprint.
Exactly. It's a real infliction point for Oscar this weekend. I think Vegas has the ability to throw up big moments, whether that's, you know, Lando binning it into a wall. Obviously, the walls are very close to the track. Various bits that, can make Lando slip up, which could close the gap. But fundamentally, mm-hmm. Oscar's lacked on pace the past few races. If he continues to lack on pace, this race, you know, we're sort of clutching at straws as to finding a realistic way back in the championship for him. It's a very tricky weekend for him, I think. We've got to hope he comes through for a win or a bit of points over Lando to keep this championship alive.
Do you believe in the Grills Burger Curse?
I do not know the Grills Burger Curse.
So right before Baku, Grilled Burger, which is an Australian burger chain, did a promotion with Oscar Piastri.
I do know this. Yes.
And you would get a free burger from Grilled Burger if Oscar Piastri got a podium. He has not gotten a podium since. And so they had to change the promo to you get a free burger with purchase of burger if Oscar races and doesn't DNF or something like that. So they had to like tweak the promotion because he hasn't been on the podium. And some people say he's being cursed by Grilled Burger.
Could be. I've seen crazier things in Formula One. It might be his favorite burger place, in which case, you know, it's mentally affecting him. He did actually say, jokes aside, that in a recent interview that the incident in Monza where Lando had the slow pit stop, Oscar was asked to let him have the place back, yada yada, that moment, from that point on he's been struggling basically. Baku was the race after that. Of course he had that shocking weekend all round, DNF. Then there was Singapore, kind of clashing with Lando there. Then we sort of saw just the general lack of pace come in, and since then he's not found his feet again. And he did come out recently saying that it was maybe on his mind a little bit, that decision in Monza to kind of be forced to let Lando back through.
Right.
Whether that's the leading factor or just something on his mind, I think for me it's the combination of, yes, that moment, but also the pressure in those final races. Once you get into that point that Oscar was, with a points advantage, you've basically got one hand on the trophy for the championship. Yep. And I think he realized that for the first point this season. Before this, he's been like, it's cool. I'm just sailing through. I'm just doing my races. We'll see what happens. Right. But he got to a point where he was like, whoa, I could actually win this. I should win this now. And that's where he lost it. So my point here is I'm interested to see how Lando responds to that same pressure. Lando arguably has one hand on that trophy. It's a 24-point swing. It's a big points difference, but it's not too big to the point where it can't change. I wonder if Lando will start to feel the pressure now of being chased rather than chasing.
Right now, Lando Norris seems very cool, calm, and collected. He, I think, internally, at least just reading like from body language and how he's conducting himself in interviews and appearances, I feel like he internally feels like he has this championship in the bag. Barring like some incredible misfortune or some like really big like driver errors that happen in the following three Grand Prix and sprint races, it feels like this all is all but shored up for Lando Norris. Like, I know we still have a lot of points left on the table, but it is most certainly his championship to lose at this point.
Absolutely. And yeah, he's done amazingly in the past few races to obviously bring down that gap. Obviously a bit of misfortune for Oscar in that, but you know, Lando has had a lot of misfortune this season. Engine failure at the Dutch Grand Prix. We saw that as arguably the title ending moment, giving Oscar a massive point swing. So, he's hit his groove at the right time, stayed in the fight. I think it's an impressive year for Lando all round. Of course he's had moments of struggle, but it's how you bounce back from that. And he's done fantastically. So, yes, I do agree. He's poised to win, but for the sake of Abu Dhabi and going all the way, I would like to see Oscar bring back some points this weekend.
Agreed. Should we get into some predictions?
Yes. Would you like to go ahead with yours? I'm intrigued.
I'll go first. So I'm these predictions are due to the reputation that Mercedes tends to perform better in cold weather. It is actually going to be quite cold in Las Vegas at night during these races. I was there last year, and I would say two of the three nights was actually pretty chilly. The race night, it warmed up a bit, which was nice. But just because Mercedes performs better in cooler temperatures, or has the reputation of performing better in cooler temperatures, I have both Mercs performing pretty well here. I have Charles Leclerc P5. I have Lando Norris P4. I have Oscar Piastri P3. But I have Kimi Antonelli P2 and George Russell P1. Kimi Antonelli, of course, there's some recency bias based on the recent performance. He's like, I feel like he's in very good form. And I just feel like the Mercs are going to do well. And George Russell is still having probably, you know, the best season of his career. And I think he's going to be able to get one more win before the end of the season. And I think that win's going to happen here in Vegas.
Yeah, that's very sound, sound logic to that prediction. I can't disagree with that. I've gone for one that's maybe a bit more, how do I describe this? It's maybe what I'd like to see as a feel good feeling, which is not the same thing as your prediction, but
yep.
It's mainly more what I'd like to see to finish the season on a fairly good note for various people. I've said Oscar P1.
You'd like to see it for the plot.
Exactly. You know, I want everyone to be smiling at the end of the year, no matter what happens.
Yep.
That's probably not going to happen. Always someone is going to be pissed off, but that's Formula One. Mm-hmm. But I've gone for, starting from the bottom, I've gone P5 Russell. I've gone P4 Norris, P3 Verstappen, P2 Leclerc, and P1 Piastri. So as I said, I would love to see a point swing go back in Oscar's favor. And I think the perfect amount would be around maybe 12 points just to bring in a bit of jeopardy. You know, Lando will start to feel like he's being chased, but it's not gone straight back to zero as a difference. I think it would set a very good precedent for the races to come, especially because McLaren should be quite strong in Qatar. So it's poised for a head-to-head in that race if that happens. Leclerc, Ferrari, just, I don't know, they need something. They need a good result. A win is unrealistic. A P2, I think, would be a fairly happy result. It maybe means that John Elkann can maybe, you know, stop commenting too much on how many drivers are talking. And
I want to talk about that before we leave, though. But I want you to continue with your predictions.
Good stuff. Max, I've put P3 just because I think he's been the best driver this season. And there's no... I wouldn't like to see him fall off the boil and us to doubt the season he's had. I think it will go down as one of the best drives of a season where they've not won the championship. You know, we see the win he had in 23, the championship he completely dominated. This is almost more impressive, in my opinion. He's had a car that clearly isn't very competitive, but he's been able to push a extremely dominant McLaren all the way. So I want him to have a good result. And yeah, Norris P4, enough points difference to keep it exciting, but doesn't sort of close off the championship or doesn't bring it back to equal points to the point where, we're left guessing. I want a bit of a momentum for someone.
Let's talk about Ferrari real quick, because I feel like we didn't get an opportunity to talk about earlier, and that was a big talking point in the news in the last few weeks. And
yes,
of course, we got the soundbite that John Elkann said the drivers need to drive less or talk less and drive more to embrace the Hamilton line: talk less, smile more. There, from top to bottom, there needs to be some changes at Ferrari. I don't think it's Fred Vasseur's fault. I actually think it goes all the way to the top of Ferrari and how the people that are running Ferrari, John Elkann, you know, other people involved in the higher echelon making decisions there, are establishing a culture within the team that's keeping them from being able to be successful.
Yeah, I think there's been a structural issue with Ferrari ever since they stopped winning with Schumacher, I'd argue. I think, yeah, there's this blame culture surrounding Ferrari and also the wider Italian Ferrari fan base, the Italian media. I feel there's just a lot of animosity around that team specifically, a lot of pressure, which has made a lot of drivers crumble in the past few years. And I think Elkin's comment just encapsulates that entirely. Essentially a very out of touch comment with what's going on, a very ignorant comment. I think if you look at what he said specifically, he was essentially saying the mechanics have won the championship with what they've done this year. And mm-hmm. while he talks about pit stops, and while they have got, you know, they've done very well with pit stops this season, they've not done some of the quickest, but on average, they're very high up. He seemed to imply that the car is getting better and better, which is frankly not true. So I think for him to say the drivers need to stop talking and start driving is, yeah, it's not the message that Ferrari want to put out. Not the message that Lewis Hamilton or Charles Leclerc wants to hear, especially after this very, very hard season. So I was pretty amazed by those comments. And hopefully something will change.
I think at this certain moment in time, we are kind of seeing history repeat itself. We all are all familiar with Ferrari's era of dominance from 1999. They won the constructors, but Schumacher didn't win the driver's championship. Mika Hakkinen did. But from 2000 to 2005, it was just straight Ferrari dominance, winning world driver's championship. Or from 2000 to 2004, straight dominance for Ferrari, winning world driver's championships and constructors, five straight years. And it was a long time coming. Before they won the constructors in 99 and both the constructors in world driver's championship in 2000, the last time they had won a constructors was 1983. The last time they had won a driver's championship was 1979. So there was like a culture issue. And it wasn't until Michael Schumacher decided to make this commitment to Ferrari, leaving Benetton after winning back-to-back championships, and then spent 4 years developing that car, four whole years, putting in thousands of hours at the test track, staying late nights, working with mechanics, working with the engineers, developing the car. It was a long time running. It took Jean Todt was the team principal at Ferrari for 7 years before they won that constructor's championship. He started in like 93, I believe. And then finally in 2000, they won both the drivers and constructors championships. During that 14-year span, Ferrari had one team principal in Jean Todt. Since then, they've had five. They've had five different team principals. And just from what I've read, it seems to be that whenever a team principal or anybody high up in Ferrari since Jean Todt left tries to establish some sort of culture and way of doing things, the higher ups at Ferrari who are above the team principal meddle in their decisions and keep them from being able to do things the way they want to be successful. And then they also don't have the patience to give them time to develop a team culture to be successful.
100%. I couldn't agree with it more. I think we see it in a lot of sports as well. I comment about this one mainly because I know it, but with football, you know, with managers, it takes them a lot of years to get a team to where they could be. Mikel Arteta at Arsenal, you know, it took him several years of slander, of accusations of getting sacked, you know, fans booing. And now look at him, he's flying in the Premier League and it looks like they could be on course to win the title. You need to give managers time in professional sports. It's a seriously high-pressure environment. As you say, they need to implement their culture. If they're not working to the culture they know, to the tools they have to deliver, they will not deliver.
Correct.
And it's up to the Ferrari corporate leadership to allow them to do that. And I think what I've sort of seen with Ferrari these past few years is they've forgotten what made them great. And mm-hmm. I think when they had Schumacher and Jean Todt, they had a massive diversity.
And Ross Braun, yeah. and Rory Byrne, who many people consider to be like the Adrian Newey of that Ferrari era. He's one of the most iconic car designers in Formula One history.
Exactly. And they had all these people. And the thing that jumps out to me is they're all from different backgrounds. They're all from different countries. They all have very different views and perspectives on how to run a Formula One team, how to build a car. And you need that diversity of opinion, of perspective when running an F1 team. If you have everyone thinking the exact same way with the exact same background, exact same teaching, you're just going to get the same result every time. There'll be no innovation, no forward thinking, no outside the box thinking. Whereas with Ferrari, with Schumacher, who was German, Ross Brawn, who was English, Rory Byrne, I think, was Irish, John Todd was French. And I know there are a few others, obviously Rubens, as the support driver, was Brazilian. You had this massive diversity.
And a lot of people give a lot of people apparently don't believe Rubens Barrichello was also very instrumental and important in Ferrari's success. Not only being willing to be a rear gunner and designated number two driver, but also was very integral in helping develop the car as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Rubens was a massive help. And I think not just for developing the car, which he was amazing for, it was also being that driver, which at the time was necessary, you know, giving in to Schumacher when he needed to. You know, he did some unbelievably selfless things for Schumacher, all in the pursuit of his title, of Ferrari's titles. So he was massively pivotal. And I think for me, when I look at Ferrari now and the past few years, they don't have that same diversity in their leadership. And that's not to discredit Italian culture and how Italians go about business. It's more you just need different views and different opinions of people from different backgrounds. And that's something they've lacked for a long time. And obviously things, Formula One's changed a lot. It may not be the same point like it was back in the 2000s where diversity was so important, but I think it's a massive, massive talking point and possibly a reason as to why they've not been so good recently.
Right. And I do want to say Ferrari have not been bad. And I made this point in a video that I posted on my Instagram and TikTok. They just have failed to be the best. They've essentially been very close many, many different times. Fernando Alonso was, 3 points away from winning the World Drivers' Championship one season? Was all like in a sliding door situation, Fernando Alonso could have won 2 or 3 World Drivers' Championships with Ferrari. Sebastian Vettel could have won 1 or 2 World Drivers' Championships with Ferrari. I'm not saying they've been bad. They have just failed to be the best.
Yeah, I think, I think agreed. But I do think the step between being good and being the best is enormous. I'd argue it's the biggest step you have to make in Formula One. And I think it's, we've been talking about the glory years of Schumacher. That's the benchmark. They've won 5 in a row in the past. And so if they're not even close to winning a championship or they haven't won at least one, you know, they kind of start going, this isn't good enough. And the high, you know, their standards should be high given that heritage. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's that sort of metal in those closing moments of a season from a team perspective that Ferrari have lacked, especially with Mercedes and Hamilton. I think, Lewis and Mercedes towards the end of a season were just consistently close out the year, whereas Ferrari would start to slip up and have weekends of misfortune or crashing or bad setup, and I think that's the difference.
I have one more question for you. Do you think part of Ferrari's inability to compete at the top and secure drivers and constructors championships, does any of that have to do with the fact that they are in Italy and 7 or 8 of the 10 teams on the grid are within an hour or so from each other in the UK?
Absolutely.
Is it hard to get talent to go to Italy?
100%. And it goes back to my point on diversity. You know, if you're based in Italy, most of your employees will be Italian, essentially. Especially as you say, you've got pretty much the whole grid with some sort of presence in the UK. And so if you're getting top talent that wants to work in Formula One, they're going to want a choice of working for various different teams. Obviously, Ferrari is iconic, but let's say, you know, you've got family in England, your friends are in England. It's harder to drag those people out to Italy and have them work for Ferrari. Toyota actually found this quite a lot in a different way when they sort of had a failed attempt at winning the championships in F1 back in the mid to late 2000s, where essentially they had a factory in Cologne, Germany. They had the head office back in Japan, and then they had another sort of outpost, I guess, in the UK. And the issue they found was having these things spread across the world, out of touch with the key markets of Formula One, such as the UK in terms of where talent is. They weren't able to communicate well enough between each teams. They weren't able to sort of bring in updates quick enough. And eventually they, despite spending what would have been, I guess, several hundred millions over several seasons, they ended up bowing out of the sport after just 5 or 6 years. This is Toyota. So it's a similar story, but it's definitely a point. Ferrari, if they want top talent, they need to be in the UK, but they're not going to relocate the team. I think we can agree on that point.
Yeah. So I guess we need to wait until the day where Ferrari finds that perfect storm, that perfect combination of driver who has the potential to be in the GOAT conversation, someone with Adrian Newey, Rory Byrne-esque ability to design a car, someone with the management skills to be the Jean Todt of this era, and someone who also has the leadership and the technical knowledge of Ross Brawn. You have to have all four of those people be at Ferrari at the same time and have like 3 or 4 years where the top brass at Ferrari just let them cook.
Yeah, essentially. I think sometimes it could just be one that brings all of them. I think I could be wrong in saying this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the pull of Schumacher caused all of them to move over. Obviously, Schumacher going to Ferrari meant Ross Brawn joined him from Benetton, where mm-hmm. Schumacher was before. So there's a bit of that. And I think, Schumacher was such a charismatic driver, and people wanted to work for him and they wanted to win with him. And the opportunity to win with Schumacher with Ferrari was probably so attractive that they just couldn't resist. Yeah. So it can just be one person shooting for the stars that causes the rest to follow. Whether that's a Verstappen, for example, could be seen.
He's young enough where he could take 3 or 4 years of not winning a championship and would still have the time and runway to win 3, 4, 5 more championships.
Definitely. He definitely could. And I think it'd be an interesting prospect seeing Verstappen at Ferrari. The only thing I know would be an issue is the media against Verstappen. You know, Max, he's a bit of a hothead at times. He can get quite flustered. I think if the whole team isn't pulling completely in his direction, it would only get ugly. Why it's been so good at Red Bull is because he's been able to own that team himself. So yeah, it would take a lot of moving parts, a lot of things to think about, considerations if Max was to go to Ferrari, but he's definitely the leading contender, I guess, to bring them back to glory on the grid. But probably wishful thinking, I reckon.
I agree with you. I don't know why he would do it. I think, like we've mentioned before, he's going to see who has the best car next year and then is going to be like, I want to go to that team.
Spot on. And he can, so I don't blame him.
Yeah, 100%. It's going to be the meme of the dude looking over his shoulder while holding his girlfriend's hand, and he's looking at the other girl wearing the red dress. And it's going to be Toto Wolff holding George Russell's hand, looking over his shoulder, looking at Max Verstappen.
100%. 100%. It could be Kimi holding George's hand, George holding Toto's hand. Toto is that He's in love with Max. We know this. He invited him on a lovely romantic trip on his yacht in Sardinia.
I think he's in love with winning. And I think he, you know, I assume in this sport, like, winning is an addiction, and he hasn't had that in a while, and he's been chasing that high, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to get back onto 100%. That top podium and win another constructors and win another driver's championship. And he will bring in anybody he can to get him there.
Yeah, for sure. It's redemption as well. You know, they've not won since 2021. And that, of course, was a moment that really affected Toto. So he's addicted to winning, but he's also got a fire in his belly from that moment in Abu Dhabi in 2021, of course, as well.
I will also say, apparently, I say like too much on this podcast.
Is that right?
Somebody.
You got some haters.
No, they were very, very nice. They were like, James, I love you, but you say like too much.
Now that is how to give a comment. I respect that.
And Phelan, shout out to you. James, I really love you, but you got to stop saying like. I think I did it a few times in this podcast, but I was trying to be conscious of not saying it too much. So if I did it a lot this podcast, call me out again.
See, and I love the way they commented, but I humbly disagree. I can't say I've noticed it at all.
I actually went back and listened, and I use it to
like a lot.
I use it to connect thoughts way too much. I use it the same way I use and something I need to learn to be better at. So, Ann Phelan, I thank you. Like,
fair enough.
Thank you.
I think it's pretty tough to go through a whole thing and not say but there you go. Tough crowd.
Right. It's just a skill. But I think that's all we have. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
All good from me. I'm excited to wake up at what will be 4 a.m. my time for a race.
But we also have the final round of F1 Academy in Vegas this weekend. Very exciting. It's been another great season. I believe it's coming down to Dorian Penn and Maya Woga racing for Ferrari and Mercedes respectively. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm super excited for Vegas. I love the Vegas Grand Prix. I am not going this year. I had the opportunity, a brand reached out to me, but it wasn't a right fit, so I declined. I'm also leaving to go to Florida for Thanksgiving early Sunday morning, so it would have been a very hectic logistical nightmare trying to figure out how to get from Vegas back to Los Angeles early Sunday morning, only to get back on a plane and fly cross country to Florida. But I cannot wait to watch it from the comfort of my living room on my couch.
Same here. It'll probably be from my bed myself.
Yeah. You're going to be watching it on your phone with all the lights off. Like,
I'll be completely honest with you, James. I've done it 2 years in a row. I will start the race and I will fall asleep.
That happened to me with Singapore this year. I started.
That's fair.
And then I was like, oh, I don't think much is going to happen. And I fell asleep. And then I woke up later and I watched the race without checking the result and finished it. So
that's quite good.
It was like I was watching it in real time.
I might set two alarms. I might set an alarm for the start and then an alarm for maybe the last 20 laps.
Love it.
Try not to sleep.
Well, if we don't have anything else to talk about, thank you so much for listening to the WTF1 podcast. I'm James Coker, along with Luke Francis of The Racing Pilot. If you like what you heard, leave a comment, like, subscribe, share it, tell your friends. If you don't like it, tell someone you hate. Tell them this is the best podcast you've ever heard and they need to listen to it. But we will be back next week reviewing the Formula One Heineken Las Vegas Grand Prix 2025. And is there a break between Vegas and Qatar? Does it go right into Qatar?
Goes straight in. So we've got a triple header.
We will be reviewing the Las Vegas Grand Prix and previewing Qatar. And we hope you just have the best week and weekend. Goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.